And the first reading is taken from Psalm 107, starting at verse 23, and that's on page 611 of the Church Bibles, starting at verse 23. Some went out on the sea in ships. They were merchants on the mighty waters. They saw the works of the Lord, his wonderful deeds in the deep. For he spoke and stirred up a tempest that lifted high the waves. They mounted up to the heavens and went down to the depths. In their peril, their courage melted away. They reeled and staggered like drunkards. They were at their wits' end. Then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the sea were hushed. They were glad when it grew calm, and he guided them to the desired haven. Let them give thanks to the Lord for his unfailing love and his wonderful deeds for mankind. Let them exalt him in the assembly of the people and praise him in the council of the elders. And the second reading is taken from Luke, and that's Luke chapter 8, beginning at verse 22, and that's on page 1037. Verse 22. One day Jesus said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side of the lake." So they got into a boat and set out. As they sailed, he fell asleep. A squall came down in the lake so that the boat was being swamped, and they were in great danger. The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we're going to drown." He got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waters. The storm subsided, and all was calm. "Where is your faith?" he asked his disciples. In fear and amazement, they asked one another, "Who is this? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him." This is the word of the Lord. Amen.
Well, it's great to be here and preaching on St. Patrick's Day. And a very happy St. Patrick's Day to you all. And I guess there are some Irish people here. Well, I know there are some Irish people here. And most people are connected with Ireland in some way or another. And you either hate them or love them. But there you are, St. Patrick. I'm going to come back to him before the end of the sermon. And our theme is Jesus Calms the Storm. As a young student, and I was a young student once, I used to be a leader in a Christian house party, or a Christian house that ran house parties for children, teenagers, young adults, and families in the beautiful west of Ireland. And this involved organizing all sorts of expeditions to all sorts of places around, in particular to the immense and sheer cliffs of Moher. It also involved, and this was a great bonus, meeting all sorts of very pretty girls, some of them from the north of Ireland. And in a glorious old seafront house, we slept in dormitories. None of this ensuite stuff. One night, I woke up shouting, terrified, and sleepwalking around the dormitory. I was falling with some of my charges off the cliffs of Moher. I didn't know what to do. And how humiliating for the leader to be terrified of the task he was undertaking, because man though he was a wimp when it came to heights. My friends, my male friends with all a great deal of pastoral empathy in those days, showed their sensitivity by leaving grass on my bed the next night with instructions. And remember, Ireland is much into horses, not to feed, grass to feed the nightmare. And that leads me on to my first point. Fear-laden storms show up our vulnerabilities. Fear-laden storms show up our vulnerabilities. In that reading that we've just had, Jesus and his disciples were getting away from the crowds, and Jesus asked his disciples to bring them to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Now, a couple of, three important things about these disciples. First, Luke, who is very concerned to give women their due place, has just at the beginning of this chapter made the point that disciples traveled with Jesus, and the disciples included women, and he gave a list of some of the women that traveled with Jesus. So very probably there were women as well as men in this group. Secondly, the Jews were not a seafaring people. For them, the sea often represented evil and chaos and a dark and threatening power. And we have glimpses of that in that Old Testament reading from Psalm 107. The Jews, a little bit like me and Heights, were not of their bravest when it came to the sea. And so we can imagine that many of the disciples were predisposed not to be greatly enamored with the thought of going in the sea. But of course, thirdly, and to make a counterpoint, there were a good number of fishermen among the disciples, and there was every reason, even amongst the most fearful, to believe that they were in the hands of seasoned professionals and they would be okay. Yes, everybody knew that storms could appear very quickly on the Sea of Galilee, but no need to worry. The professionals had been brought up, boy and man, on the sea, and their skill and judgment could be relied on. So sit back, put on the factor 50, and like Jesus, take the chance of getting a bit of sleep. And then the storm struck. And picture postcard tranquility was replaced by terrifying danger. And if we have our picture back, note the little detail in Rembrandt's picture of the non-fisherman being sick. It's quite a famous picture. If any of you see it anywhere, do let the authorities know, because it was stolen in Boston back in 1990 and nobody knows where it is. But anyway, Jesus is asleep there. And that leads on to my next point. Fear-laden storms cause us to cry out in despair. Master, Master, verse 24, we're going to drown. Or as Mark has it, Jesus is, they challenge Jesus even more directly. Do you not care, Jesus, if we perish? Lord, they were in effect saying, you're not interested in us and our fears and our terror, our safety and our despair. And here is something important. The disciples were perfectly right to bring their despair to the Lord. Read the Psalms or Jeremiah or Job or listen to Jesus in Gethsemane, and you will hear that voice of accusation sometimes brought, that God isn't caring, that God has forsaken them. Perhaps those disciples had assumed that they were safe because Jesus is with them. And don't we very easily assume that everything will be all right because Jesus is with us? And in a sense, everything will be all right because he is with us. But what we cannot guarantee is that everything is going to turn out as we think it should or we want it to turn out. As the great theologian Jim Packer puts it, when something very painful and quite inexplicable comes along, our cheerful illusion that we know that God is going to do what God is going to do is shattered, then our world begins to collapse if we think that we can be certain that God is going to meet our every whim. What do we do when we don't see God handling the storm? Some people give up on God. Why does he Why does he allow suffering like this? Why doesn't he act? And what this passage challenges to do is to call on the Lord, to trust his presence and purpose, even when we can't see any evidence that he seems to be changing the situation very much. Next point is that fear-laden storms challenge us to have faith. And that's exactly what the disciples did. They challenged Jesus to act, and he did. They had faith that he would do something. The psalm that we read speaks of the sailors caught up in a dreadful storm and crying out to the Lord. And the psalm goes on, they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. And in our story, it's Jesus they cry to, and it's King Jesus that acts in the way they would expect of God acting, giving the disciples, by the way, compelling evidence of his divinity. Here was somebody acting and able to still the storm in the way that they had assumed that only God could. And Jesus immediately then challenges the disciples about their lack of faith. But they did have some faith, and even the most minuscule, even the most minuscule amount of faith when we are in situations of storm, or indeed in any situations, is of enormous importance. Our next point is that the most basic protection against storms is to be in a ship with a captain we can trust. And that's a pretty obvious point, but what does it mean in Christian terms? One frequent early church image of the church is actually of a ship. And when those early Christians were being persecuted, as they often were, they quite frequently worshipped in hidden catacombs. And there they sometimes scrawled pictures of ships on the walls. And those ships, to them, symbolize the church amid the dangerous stormy waters of the hostile sea. And they also reminded them, because of the mast, the cross mast, of the cross every time they looked at them. It would have been too dangerous for them to scrawl up crosses, because then immediately, if they were chased, their pursuers would know that they'd been worshipping here. Their pursuers wouldn't know what a ship, they wouldn't know what a ship was, but they wouldn't know of its Christian connection. And that imagery, and this is quite interesting, the imagery of the church as a ship remained after persecution ended. When I go to church, as I've done tonight, I don't often think that I'm in a ship, but there is a sense in which I am in a ship. Mary and I usually sit in the nave, the long central aisle. And if you come to think of it, doesn't it look a little bit like an upturned ship? The keel being the roof. It looks more like it in that picture on Fleur than perhaps here, but this does look a little bit like it too. And those of you who go to the church's Latin classes, this is probably the only church in the country that has Latin classes, will know that the nave is from the Latin word navis, which means ship. In other words, church architecture has deliberately kept the link between church and ship through all these centuries and millennia. We are when we're in the church, in a sort of sense, we're in a ship. And that I at any rate, in a ship that's often on hostile waters. And I find that a helpful thought. We need to be in a ship, and we need not to be paddling our own canoes. And it needs to be the right ship. If we're in any other ship but that of the church and of any other captain but King Jesus, we're in a ship of fools where everyone is doing their own thing, and that can only lead to a disastrous end. The ship with King Jesus at the helm will survive any storm. The disciples emerge from all this event rather poorly, but they do get a few things right, and they're worth holding on to. They didn't blame each other. Rather, they were concerned for each other. We are not I am. We are perishing. Most crucially, they came to Jesus with a need. They wanted him to take charge. And when the storm was stilled, they shared with each other their mystified wonder at what Jesus has done. He commands. They whispered to each other, even water, wind and water, and they obey him. And three crucial things for us in passing as the ship of the church: concerned support for each other, a common commitment to King Jesus, and communication with each other. And so to the final key thought: the Lord has a purpose through fear-laden storms. The disciples, first of all, learned unforgettable lessons. Years later, Peter, living in a very hostile world and facing himself a very uncertain future, looked back at events such as this and wrote, "We were witnesses of his majesty." They came to realize that Jesus was divine, that he was Lord, and that he was Lord, their Lord, but Lord of the universe, Lord of the world. They learned, secondly, that following Jesus was no guarantee of a storm-free life. Yes, Jesus stilled this storm, but only after the disciples had experienced far more storm than they were comfortable with. And that was made all the more puzzling because that storm happened when Jesus was with them, asleep, apparently absent in their time of crisis. They learned, thirdly, that though the Lord does not cause storms, he uses them to challenge and strengthen our characters. "Where," Jesus asked, "is your faith? Why didn't you rely on me? Why did you go into meltdown?" They needed to learn so much. And the Lord doesn't still storms just to make us comfortable. He is, as Rick Warren puts it, less interested in our comfort than in our character. Less interested in our comfort than in our character. And this short little story in the Gospels shows how through the storm the disciples learned critical lessons about the power of Jesus and about the need for them to live by faith in this hostile world, live by faith in King Jesus. And here is something of immense practical importance. There are those who appear to teach that walking with Jesus means that every storm will be stilled, every illness removed, every conflict resolved, every personal ambition realized, every intractable relationship smoothed to idyllic harmony. Now, the big picture of the Bible gives no support for such a belief. What this passage, and indeed the whole sweep of the Bible, teaches is that the Lord's timing in our storm may well be different from our ideal, but that all things will work together for good for those who love God. Back in 1988, I was at a bit of a crossroads in my life. I felt that the time had come to move on from the work I was doing as a vice principal at a theological college. And then I was pleased to be shortlisted to become a principal of a theological college. And I didn't get the job. And there was disappointment, particularly because people I knew, trusted, and looked up to had pressed me very strongly to apply. And there were other closed doors through the next 3 years, and Mary and I lived with an undercurrent of uncertainty and a sort of mini storm of doubt about what to do next. But finally, I was offered and accepted what turned out to be the perfect job for me, for us. Mary and I know now, beyond a shadow of doubt, that the Lord's timing, though difficult to understand, was exactly right for us. As it so happens, I know well and greatly admired the man who got the job as principal, as we've been in college together. And John Golden-Gay's story illustrates how the Lord goes with us through even the fiercest storms. John is an enormously intellectually gifted man, and he married an enormously gifted wife and a consultant psychiatrist. And shortly before they were married, Anne was diagnosed with a neurological condition. Like many of their friends, we at college prayed for healing, and Anne did have a couple of decades, a very substantial amount of time, of remission. But the condition came back in the late 80s. Needless to say, there was much prayer for her healing, but this time, God did not heal her. But he did give some assurances that he was in this. As at his inauguration service as principal of the college, John recounts how a friend had a word for him from the Lord about the storm of suffering he was going through. "I will make the north wind your warmth, the snow your purity, the frost your brightness, and the night sky of winter your illumination." It was more, John writes, than proved over the following years as Anne's condition deteriorated markedly over time, eventually she being unable to swallow or even speak. And for John, pushing a wheelchair epitomized for him their common suffering. "I pushed the wheelchair for 20 years. And despite the support, I often wondered how long? With hindsight, I'm glad I didn't know the answer, as I'm not sure I could have lived with it. I wouldn't say God ignored me or hid his face from me through those 20 years. I know God was with me. God was like a father or a teacher or a coach, leaving his son or his pupil or his trainee to get on with a demanding task. And God was watching, not ignoring me." And then that storm, in a sense, came to an end for Anne and John when she passed to glory some 10 years ago in 2009. But why did the Lord allow that storm to drag on so long? And at one level, there's no answer we can make. We haven't got an access to the answer. But as John puts it, the fact that we do not know what might explain our suffering, what purpose God might have in it, does not constitute the slightest suggestion that the suffering has no explanation. We don't know it. There is an explanation which one day we will know. "I cannot imagine," he goes on, "the story that makes it okay for God to have made Anne go through what she has been through. But I can imagine there is such a story." And perhaps we can now, 10 years on, see little glimpses of what that story might be. It is clear that Anne, by her fragility, dependence, and uncertainty in her illness, made an enormously positive impact on people. John used to go to conferences with Anne, and he found that people were far more interested in speaking to her than listening to what he was saying. What they went away with, in a sense, was a memory of her. Dealing with her illness also changed John, and for the better. John is one of those brilliant men who can easily be impatient with anybody who's less sharp than he is, and that's about 99.5% of the world's population. And right in the middle of the storm, he wrote of the impact of Anne's illness on his character. As well as having an institutional power which I can misuse, I can beat students in an argument most of the time if I choose to do so. Imagine what a so-and-so I might have been if it were not for the positive shaping effect on me of Anne's disability. I know she slows me down for good. Often we will be processing through the college dining room with half the college behind us. But I have the impression no one minds. She makes me appreciate simple things like squirrels and clouds and the swaying of the willow tree outside our house. And Anne's story has helped many people, as well as molding John's character. That storm has given him an extraordinary post-storm ministry, as he's written 17 volumes in a series called The Old Testament for Everyone, all published within the last eight years. Now, I think it's pretty substantial to write 17 books in 8 years. And in those books, there is a combination of theological knowledge and the sort of spiritual wisdom, honesty, and realism that could only come from deep reflection on what it means to go through a storm of suffering. And he's also been granted the bonus of great personal happiness and fulfillment in his remarriage. When one of Rick and Kate Warren's sons committed suicide a few years ago, their pain was almost unbearable. But they came to understand that through that horrendous experience, God gave them a new dimension of service. God, they said, wants to take our greatest pain and turn it into our life message. He wants to use our mess for a message. And right now, some of us will undoubtedly be, for all sorts of reasons, in the midst of horrendous storms, perhaps of our making, perhaps not. Right now, some of us will be doubting whether the Lord cares. Right now, our faith may be very weak and faint. Call out to the Lord. Remember, the Lord will be with us in our storms, that his grace is sufficient, and that he wants to use the storm to shape us into the people he wants us to be. And remember, too, that the Lord may be using the storm to shape us in totally unpredictable directions. As an example of a totally unpredictable direction, I want to finish with an image that St. Patrick left us. He was, as you may know, captured by wild Irish raiders in Britain when he was a boy of 16 and forced to tend pigs in a farm. This is all back in the 5th century, by the way, in Northern Ireland. Though he was from a Christian family, he did not, he tells us, know the true God. However, through the storm experience, he found the Lord who strengthened and comforted me as a father does his son. Eventually, he escaped back to the safety of Britain. But then he had a dream where he dreamt that the Lord was calling him to return and evangelize those wild, awful Irish, the very people who'd caused him his misery. Apart from the danger, apart from the fact that all his family told him that he would be mad to go, he felt that he'd been very badly damaged by the storm he'd gone through, that he was very ill-equipped for such a task by the captivity. He was an uneducated person. He was uncouth. He was rustic. He hadn't been properly, he'd missed so much because of his captivity. He felt useless. He felt, as he put it, like a stone lying in the deep mire, like a stone lying in the deep mire. But he went on, he that is mighty came and in his mercy lifted me up and raised me aloft and placed me on the top of the wall. And perhaps some of us feel like Patrick, so damaged or puzzled or disabled or hurt by our storms that we feel like useless stones lying in deep mire. The message of the Bible, a message that happens to come in this imagery through Patrick, is the Lord wants to pick us out of the deep mire and place us in his wall. He wants us to focus on his power, his love, his purpose, and allow that focus to teach us through the storm, not to sink under the storm.